Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
We are here again in the Tested office, doing something a little different. Secret meeting was earlier this morning. We talked about that last week. We're going to just get right into it this week. A few weeks ago, you talked to some folks at Etsy.
I did.
And they had questions.
Well, we talked about Etsy a lot.
We like Etsy.
Yeah. We love Etsy.
Great place to shop.
I purchase stuff from Etsy all the time.
It's one of those ideas. I really am bummed that I wasn't bright enough to come up with that about 10 years ago, because it's super obvious now, and it's a big deal. It's
my
big
idea thing. Was Google.
You should. Yeah. You
had. I'm bummed I didn't come out with that idea.
Do you know a good friend of mine in 1995 outlined for me Google Street View?
Really?
Yep.
And totally, you told him,
and I was like
a camera in a car.
He was like, why can't I take pictures of every building in New York and assemble it into a map where you can, like, location scout a city without going there?
This was right after playing Quake.
Probably.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, there's just... I said, it's a great idea. Actually, I didn't poo-poo the idea. I said, the idea is brilliant. But you know, in order to make that happen, you're going to have to live, eat, sleep, and breathe this for, like, half a decade to make it happen. It's so much infrastructure to make that work.
At the time, by the time you finished, it would be like that road, the road that goes all the way across the length of Mexico, where they start, and then they finish, and then they just go back again and start again, because it's
crowdsourcing wasn't a thing back then.
Right.
We got to see last week what the Google Street View car sees. I mean, not the Street View, the self-driving car. Have you seen those driving around?
I got a ride in this self-driving car a couple of years ago when I did a talk at Google, and it is so beautiful to watch how it not only turns people into cylinders and cars into blocks moving through the landscape, but how you can also watch it predict their trajectory based on their movement.
Well, the feedback from the sensor looks like something from a science fiction movie, basically.
Point graph.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really, really cool. It's gorgeous. I'm very excited about the autonomous car. I think that in 20 or 30 years, most major currently congested downtowns of major cities won't allow non-autonomous cars.
Yeah,
like
that's the only way it would work.
Yeah, you'll have to cede your control of your car when you enter a downtown area so that the traffic planners can actually plot delivery traffic and make it run really smoothly. We'll all still be able to control our cars honestly, the idea of cars just driving you from one place to another, that's like 100 years away.
Yeah.
Like fully driving you from one place to another, because people will always want to drive.
Well, but people said that 100 years ago about people always wanting to ride their horses too. So,
at the same time, I think that I feel like culturally the desire to drive your own car is so ingrained in us, it will take 3 or 4 generations to really weed it out. Plus, you've got that last mile of, all the rural communities throughout the world. What, really?
So I saw the Street View car. I mean, not the Street. I keep saying Street View. I saw the autonomous car driving on surface roads in San Francisco the other day.
Oh, really?
Which I hadn't seen before. I feel like the highway is probably easier.
Not the speed of the car and the amount of other cars,
but
the velocities.
There's less unpredictable stuff. There's no pedestrians on the freeway. The potential for failure is much lower.
Right.
And there's much less unpredictability. The worst thing that happens is everybody in front of you stops, or a dog runs across the freeway.
Right.
This one came off at Vermont, where I got off to go to work, turned left by the UPS place, went underneath the freeway, and was going down 16th as if it was going toward the Mission. It was really crazy. I had not seen that before. And it may not have been self-driving at that point, but... It was somewhat unexpected.
That's fascinating. I love that thing. So when I got a ride in it, my eyes were glued to the computer showing its brain and its thinking methods, even down to watching it parse the lane as it merged to get off the freeway. Mm-hmm. That was awesome.
The neat thing that was unexpected to me and makes sense is it uses LiDAR. The sensor uses LiDAR. It's made by a company that makes headphones as well. It starts with a V, and I can't remember it. Norm, do you remember?
Velodyne,
I think, yeah. And there's because it's light, there's shadows. So when there's a car in the lane beside the Google car, if it can't see over that car, then the area on the other side of it is unknown, and there be dragons, I guess.
Laser radar.
So right now, Well, first off, you should explain what you're doing for the people on
video. Oh, sorry. I've gotten some new lovely little pieces of camera gear from Zacuto. And they're from my camera, my FS700. And I'm nulling. I'm just nulling.
Is it about the brain that we like regular angles and straight lines and things that fit uniformly with other things?
I don't know, but I tell you, my intuition says it has something to do with the reason we love music, too.
Well, the reason we love music is pattern recognition. Recent studies, we get the same type of the same triggers when we listen to music as other pleasure activities.
You know, I love doing this. It's tough with a flat surface and objects that aren't completely level, but I find it. Whenever I'm having a conference call, this is what I'm doing. I'm in my space doing it. And actually, I have noticed that my nulling, if I'm having a difficult call, I still null. But if I'm having a call where I'm really upset and trying to communicate something emotional, like if I'm arguing a point with a loved one or Jamie and I have had some difficult calls, I don't know. I'm totally concentrated on the thing. But for me, this is sort of it's sort of an ongoing.
Rather than click your pen.
Right. Yeah. I don't click the pen. I have actually had people being able to hear me nulling in the background. And I just say, listen, to null you is to love you.
Do you go for...
That's a t-shirt.
Wow. Wow.
I actually texted that to my wife the other night. I'm in a hotel room in Utah, and I have been walking back and forth between the bathroom and the bed, and I'm nulling some of the stuff from my bag on both. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I took a picture of each and texted it to her with that, to null you is to love you. But we were talking about Etsy.
I think we were a while ago. Mm. We were talking about Etsy because you, after we talked about Etsy on this show a few weeks ago, months ago, I guess now, and your octopus cane, your squid, it was squid or octopus?
Octopus. My octopus cane. And I, you know, I like I said, I get stuff on Etsy all the time. We've talked about it many, many times. And the Etsy community was very excited that I was talking about Etsy.
Yeah.
And came up with some questions. 10 questions?
I believe 10, although I don't know that we'll get to all of them.
We'll go a little long today.
We'll run down the list.
Can we go long?
We have the technology to go long. On the topic of going long, because we haven't talked about this, and I think people thought Norm was watching his phone when we were doing the last few episodes.
technology.
Yeah, we've been experimenting with using Norm's Canon 6D to shoot Still Untitled, and that has a hard-coded 30-minute video
limit. All DSLRs and all cameras... Thanks. Photo cameras that shoot video.
Thanks, Germany.
Yes.
because of tariffs, thanks, basically.
And Norm also a 32 gigabyte SD card.
It turns out, yeah, we learned important lessons.
Thus you got
to watch High Speed Chloe on the last episode of the second to last episode of the show. Anyway, I built a timer so that we won't have to do that in the future, and that it just stops at 30 minutes. It says, "Hey, stop talking."
But the Etsy questions
are. As followed, the most asked
question.
Hold on,
wait a second.
Gesundheit.
I had to sneeze. Thank you. All right.
You know, there are cultures where they don't say Gesundheit or bless you.
I do. This isn't one of them, so we don't have to worry about it.
No, I know.
know the joke about the woman who's in Germany? She doesn't speak a word in German, but she sneezes and someone says Gesundheit, and she says, oh, thank God someone here speaks English.
The most asked question by far was a surprise. Many people wanted to know how Adam browses Etsy. How do you browse? Do you start at the homepage? Do you use keywords? Are you looking at categories, colors? When you're looking around on Etsy, what are the sorts of things that really stand out to you about a seller or their store?
That's great. I want to start from the beginning and say Etsy's practice of, and I don't know whether they do this daily or hourly or what the protocol is, of grouping things together on the homepage of 9 or 12 things that you can see when you go to Etsy first, and they're generally of a similar color or a similar attitude or shape.
I think of it as a game, as why are these things connected? And usually it's color, but
usually
it seems
it's color. But it's a very broad approach to color, and I think it's one of my favorite homepages because of it's blue things, but one's a boat and the other is a piece of jewelry and another is like a croissant. I mean, they're super different.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll click on things that I see on the homepage. But that's the most common way I go to Etsy is I do searches for the things that I'm interested in. Sometimes it's movie props. Sometimes it's pieces of British naval hardware. Sometimes it's I'll bounce back and forth between Etsy and eBay. Like I said, I have a set of standard search terms for things that I'm interested in. And then often as I'm looking through stuff, I'll come across other things that pique my interest, and then I'll use those as a jumping-off point. If I find someone that makes something I like, I will browse their store for a while.
Okay.
And then that also may give me... I really like the unexpected leap.
Well, it's one of those things that got lost with the rise of sites like Amazon and eBay was the kind of ability to browse. And I think Etsy is one of the better browsing experiences.
I totally agree.
To give you that kind of unexpected, because there's always something that's one or two axes off.
Do you sort by stuff that's only handmade or materials?
No, I generally don't. When I've got a category I really like, I usually sort by highest price first. And I do that because...
People do the opposite.
Yeah, I'm usually the other way, Adam.
What I find is that the sorting by the highest price first, I don't do that because I want to spend the most money. I do that because you tend to find the most robust product at that highest price. Yeah. And it gives you an idea about the spectrum. When you sort by lowest price on eBay, what you've got is like 4,000 like things that cost 3 cents.
Right. If you're searching for camera stuff, then it'll be the screw that you use to hold the camera on the tripod.
Exactly. So the noise to signal ratio searching low to high is unfortunately
32 pages. At $5.
So if I'm interested in something, so a really good example of that is over Christmas, my wife and I made a mole. Do you want this timer? Oh, you're giving it to me.
I'm giving you more stuff to null.
Over Christmas, my wife and I made a really elaborate mole.
A sauce.
Yeah, a mole sauce. It's a chocolate sauce. It's effectively a chocolate sauce. It's a Mexican cooking. Requires many, 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 many steps. Many, like dozens and dozens of ingredients. All that had to be ground and prepped. And we have little mortar and pestle. And we've got some good blenders and stuff like that. Oh, yeah, I've got stuff in my pockets. And
I'm a terrible, distracting left and right.
And at the end of making the mole, which was amazing, we made 5 pounds of it. And we made some incredible mole food and mole chicken and stuff. But then we also bagged and vacuum packed a bunch of the others and gave it out as Christmas presents. Now, because we had so much fun doing this, and by the way, making a really elaborate mole, Tracy Desjardins called it the gift that keeps on giving because mole gets everywhere. And when she told us that, apropos of nothing, somebody looked up and we realized we had spots from the mole mixing on our ceiling.
Grinding just constantly?
You're grinding constantly and you're mixing this
giant bowl.
A giant bowl, and it's very thick. It gets very thick. Tracy actually gave us some really good advice about deconstructing the mole, for a modern kitchen, so that you mix the ingredients and then get them wet later, and you grind them up in different stages than the recipe often says. But this is all a point to that I wanted to find a large mortar and pestle.
Okay.
And I found it on Etsy. And what I found was the largest mortar and pestle anyone who sees it has ever seen.
It's
giant.
Like looking at the sun.
It's like 18 inches in diameter. It weighs like 35 pounds. And it was found exactly that way, searching high price to low price. And it was a terrific find. Because I found the exact thing that I wanted that way.
So when you look at a seller, like, are you more attracted to sellers that are like that sell a lot of the similar things, or do you go for sellers that maybe have a wide variety of?
Well, I mean, so most sellers who make something are making something within a bandwidth. You know, whether it's crafty or they make knives or they make movie prop guns or something like that. It's within a bandwidth. I don't mind it if someone sells similar stuff. But if someone makes something I think is really cool and they make a lot of other different things, I love that.
Okay.
I really enjoy that. And like somebody has an aesthetic that I like. I've bought paintings on Etsy. I've bought drawings and prints and stuff. And you know, if somebody sells a kind of a print, like a map or something that I like, I did buy some recent documents, some letters of the mark from a calligrapher on Etsy who makes these lovely replica letters of the mark, which is a letter of the mark is something you would have gotten in Napoleonic England that would have allowed you to effectively be a legal pirate as long as the ships you were robbing were French.
Makes perfect sense. Who wouldn't want to rob from the French?
And it was one of the ways in which the British kept their navy really robust was that, you know, the crew of a ship could share in the spoils of a ship that they captured. So that put their backs really into it, because you could absolutely get nice and rich being a naval seaman in the British navy in around the
totally goes the well with century. Your master yeah. and commander.
Yeah exactly.
So the second most asked question.
Yeah.
As asked by Doug and Chelsea Lure, have you ever used any Etsy purchases in myth-busting stuff? And lots of people apparently volunteered to have stuff blown up. Also,
I'm positive that at some point I have used something I've bought on Etsy on the show, most likely as part of a costume. For purchasing stuff to use on the show, that's almost always last minute.
Okay.
Because of the way we shoot the show, it's very seat of the pants, and it works that way. And because it's seat of the pants, sellers like Etsy or eBay don't really work for us, because sometimes you can get stuff overnight, but most of the time it's going to take a little longer. Now that my username is known on Etsy, I do get a little better. I get a more personalized service because people like they want to get it to me. They're excited that I'm buying something from them, and I like that. I appreciate that. Everyone's. You know, the Etsy community has been really fabulous. And also, my inbox isn't overly full of, you know, strange non sequitur fan requests. It's mostly just that I get, well, it's the thing I always liked about Etsy was that you were able to deal directly with the seller and the maker of the thing. I've been dealing with a guy who makes prop guns on there, and I just bought a couple of things from him. And, you know, I love that dialogue. I love that interaction.
So, This is a little, maybe we'll ask him later if he's around, but Calliope Designs wants to know what Jamie thinks of Etsy, if you know.
I what Jamie thinks of anything is a mystery to anyone. He'll probably go, well, sure.
Etsy. Yeah. Mary Ellen Cool, I'm not going to say your last name, Mary Ellen, I apologize because I'll just mangle it. How did you make the leap from sculpting to science? Are you ambi-brained? And a lot of somebody else wanted to know if you were sinusoidal. I don't know what sinusoidal means.
Sinusoidal.
S-I-N-U-S-O-I-D-A-L.
Yeah, I only know
that. Is that the two-sided of the brain thing?
I'm not sure. I know it as a word used in that wonderful fake GE Turbo Encabulator video. Oh, we should do a whole. Oh,
we need to watch this.
Oh, yeah. We'll watch it right after this. Okay. It's one of the funniest things you've ever seen. Anyway, sorry.
Perfect. It's a map projection.
The making brain to the science brain. For me, there is a direct intersection between the two. When I was a maker, I'm still a maker. When I was making things for a living in the special effects industry, I think that one of the things that made me valuable as an employee was I was always interested in what the big picture was. And that means I was interested in what I was making and how it fit into the bigger picture. Because if I knew that, I could often come up with efficiencies and maybe even whole new solutions that would fit the big picture better than what my supervisor or art director had given me.
Right.
And once I worked with an art director who saw that I could do that, I got the added bonus of getting a lot more freedom to do what I wanted to do. So, for instance, I was working on episode one and on episode two. A similar thing happened. Doug Chang, the production designer, I don't know if he was officially listed as a production designer, but he really was the production designer, would make the rounds every day. And he'd go by every model maker's table and, you know, you'd have questions for him. What do you think this should look like? He'd make a little sketch or something. Or, you know, good, good. No, no, no. Stop that and move in this direction. And one of the things that Doug is really brilliant at, in addition to being an amazing designer, is if he saw you understood, he would give you less and less feedback because you were just on the right path. And that's a lovely thing to find an art director who's willing to do that, because it just means you're having more fun. You're coming up with aesthetic solutions to stuff.
You're asking why.
It's clear that you understand why. So when we started doing Mythbusters, which we were hired to do because of our special effects background, because building stuff was our living, and building stuff out of new materials every day was our living, made us uniquely suited to do Mythbusters. But the why is always something that I've been interested in. And I have always been interested in science, but doing Mythbusters increased that by a couple of orders of magnitude. Knowing the why, knowing how what I'm doing fits into the bigger picture in terms of physics, and in terms of getting people interested in physics, and in terms of getting people to understand complicated things in a simple way, that why, because that was a part of... Yeah, so that was part of the reason that I kept getting hired as a model maker, and it's part of what makes me a good scientist on Mythbusters.
Well, whether you're making or doing science stuff on Mythbusters, you have to understand how the underlying how everything else works in relation to. You don't have to, but it's easier, and I think a lot of those skills overlap pretty strongly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Elizabeth Ringwald asks, where do you feel the indie crafts movement is going, and where will it end up? Is mainstream America ready to go back to its roots and toss out mass-produced, outsourced products?
Well, it's funny. Yeah. I can't see a future where we toss out mass-produced products.
I don't want handmade toilet paper.
Artisanal chamber pots.
Right.
At the same time, you know, I was just in Utah, and I spent a lot of time driving through locations through Utah to get to locations. And, you know, you see the same thing wherever you go in the United States, which is strip malls everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not just strip malls everywhere. That's not necessarily a problem. The problem is that for decades, nobody has been thinking about building communities where you can walk from one place to another. Everything is drive. Yeah. I mean, you know, we were staying in this hotel where to cross the street to the Mexican restaurant across the street, you took your life into your hands because you're crossing a 6-lane highway. I consider those two things quite linked. Walking through a town center and buying stuff that's not mass-produced are quite analogous procedures to me. I think the maker movement is only getting stronger. Maker Faire is getting bigger every year. There's more of them happening all over the world every year. Sites like Etsy are, to me, the on-the-ground example that an open community can actually produce a viable income for a number of small makers. There's people who have been able to quit their jobs because of stuff they sell on Etsy.
Yeah.
And that... Etsy's, like I've said this before, it's exactly what I would have been doing 20 years ago when I first got to San Francisco if Etsy existed back then.
And there's an increasing number of those Etsy in-person events.
Yeah.
You know, the Bazaar Bazaar and stuff like that.
It's not just Etsy.
The Bazaar Bazaar is great. Yeah. I've been going there for 5 years, and that's a terrific example of, that sort of craft thing. I think it's only getting stronger. I think also with communities, other parts of the DIY community, Arduino, Raspberry Pi, robotic control, that kind of stuff is also part and parcel of the craft community. And the more we're able to hack our home electronics to our real specific needs, the stronger that community gets. At the same time, you've got a corporate culture which is trying to limit that. I mean, it's my one beef with Apple is the idea of the completely closed system. I should be allowed to move my fucking songs to more than 5 devices.
Really? They still have the five device limit?
Yeah. I just ran into that restriction on my computer the other day. iTunes?
We can help you with this.
I think that's the first time I've cursed on any of our podcasts.
There'll also be a list of all the other times you've cursed on our podcast.
Okay, probably.
Yeah.
But again, all these things are linked in my brain, but to me, they all come back to the person having control over their own ecosystem of the things that they consume.
But the culture of community, what communities mean.
And the culture of community, absolutely.
I just think about, I mean, the last time we talked about Etsy on this podcast, we were talking about giving gifts. And I just really, the times that I've given a gift that I went to Walmart and picked something out to hand to someone, that's exactly the same as in every other Walmart in the country. And the times I've gone out and found something that's unique, whether it's at someplace like the Bazaar Bazaar or on Etsy or from a Kickstarter, or a business that was started as a Kickstarter, the kind of joy that you get out of those things that are special is so much more. And you reach out to touch the pen that I was that I've been staring at this whole time. it's just about it feels better. And I think that as more people do that, as people give gifts that are unique and are special, then that stuff will only spread.
And that community will also involve, so they move out of certain holes, like aesthetic holes that they know resonate. Like, you know, not everything has to have an owl on it.
No,
or a bird.
Look, let's also be realistic. The mass production has brought untold benefit to humanity.
Oh, yeah.
Where we have, you know, washing machines and durable goods are so much less expensive that everyone can benefit from that. These are remarkable things that have happened in the past two or three generations.
Yeah.
Clothing, food. It's unfortunate that when you use a free market to make calories cheaper, they're full of butter and fat and everyone gets full of butter and fat.
Or they're engineered to make
eat as much as humanly possible. Yes.
We got to talk about that, too. I mean,
we totally do. But, you know, I it's not to say I'm anti-mass production. I have worked in merchandising. I understand the process, and I think it has great benefits for humanity and society. But I think a proper balance of that with communities that you can walk through and things that you can buy from people that you know also is a huge and important and vital public good.
So like butter and fat, mass production is good in moderation.
I want to put my own butter and fat. You should have seen the pork belly omelet I made last night.
Intrigued.
It was fantastic.
I would like to subscribe to your newsletter.
Well, here's the thing about pork belly is once you cook pork belly, when you properly cure it in salt and sugar and then you slow cook it, you can freeze it for up to a year.
Wow, really?
Well, we vacuum bag it.
Okay.
And then we freeze it. And we've pulled it out of the freezer and thawed it and thrown it on a frying pan to use in banh mi or other cooking stuff. Up to a year later, it's fantastic. And David Chang confirmed for me that, it's a very, very long shelf life in a freezer.
Another gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. So I pulled some pork belly out of the freezer from about 3 months ago, and I fried it, cut it up into little chunks, and threw it inside with some fresh white onions
chopped
up in an omelet, and it was fantastic. Spectacular. Okay, next Etsy question.
Next sexy Etsy question. Gina Garvin says, what advice would you give kids interested in pursuing science and the arts? Do you think science and the arts can be combined? And do you think science and the arts can be combined into new fields of study and or employment?
I totally do. I think that the thing that's happening now, and I think Mythbusters has hopefully played a small role in getting people to understand this, is that science is a deeply creative field.
Mm-hmm.
And culturally, when I was a kid, science was the field that you would refer to talk about the opposite of creativity. It was just people making lists and stuff like that. But I think that people are understanding now, with the communities that the web engenders, that science is very creative. You also have, I just lost my train of thought. I started thinking about communities of scientists doing art. I mean, that's the other one, is you have a lot of wonderful art over the past 20 years based deeply and embedded deeply in science.
And math, yeah.
And mathematics. And, you know, a kid... Getting kids, the question was getting kids interested, or advice I'd have for kids who are interested?
Advice would you have for kids who are interested in pursuing science and the arts?
You know, I think that I don't know. I mean, I just kept on following the things I was interested in. I'd say more to the parents of kids who are interested in science and the arts. Neither costs a lot to support at its most basic level.
Yeah.
Science and art are both relatively inexpensive hobbies. There's a girl in Berkeley 10 or 15 years ago who, as her science fair project, decided to find out how accurate the mechanical timers in Berkeley's parking meters were. Now, Berkeley had rejected actually testing this themselves, saying the study would cost them umpteen hundreds of thousands of dollars. And she actually did it herself in a few weeks and showed that that the mechanical timers in Berkeley's parking meters were all set slightly too fast.
So you'd see
3 more minutes, but your parking meter would have already expired.
Conspiracy.
I'm not sure if that's a definition of fascist, but
parking meter fraud is aside from SEC fraud. Well, anyway,
you have many things about Lovely Rita.
There's a phrase that Alexander Jason, who has become an honorary MythBuster, he's our ballistics expert. We've used him on about a dozen episodes over the years. He gave me this phrase, and I told him immediately after I heard it, I'm stealing it. I'm going to say it as often as I can. The only difference between science and screwing around is writing down the results in your notebook. And, you know, to somebody who thinks that they're interested in science, the moment you start actually gathering data and being able to compare something that you've done to something else that you've done, you're a scientist. You are doing science. You are looking at data and you are comparing it to stuff. And it's thrilling when you actually do.
Well, and the other thing you said about fostering, pay attention to what your kids are interested in and foster those interests. I mean, my parents did that for you. From talking to your parents absolutely did that for you.
Yeah.
If you figure out the things that they're into, and it's going to change a ton, because what I was interested in when I was 10 years old was completely different than what I was interested in when I was 8 years old, but they found activities and stuff that we could do that would kind of encourage that behavior, and eventually I found the stuff that I wanted to do on my own, and I ended up someplace that was right for me, and I have a lot of faith that happens if you apply yourself and are smart and really just apply yourself.
Agreed. Yeah. You know, the other thing I would say, and here's where being a child is antithetical to being a scientist. When you're a kid, one of the first things that happens, and it starts to happen around middle school, is you must know everything. Hungry child's brain wants to know everything. And you start extrapolating, you find out that you can't extrapolate, and so it's very exciting for you. But you don't know everything. And if you're a kid and you think you're interested in science, you need to know that you don't know anything. You need to know that everything you think right now, 5 years from now, you're going to think, what an idiot I was. 5 years from now, everything you think, you're probably wrong about most of it. I have found this consistently in my whole life. I look back at myself 5 years ago. Nope, you were wrong about that. You were wrong about that. You were wrong about that.
22-year-old me was a real
idiot. Something to look forward to.
And you really need to embrace that. A scientist is willing to change their mind based on new data. You need to be willing to be wrong. You need to be willing to have your mind changed. And you will find that the smartest people that you meet as you move through life are the ones who are willing to ask the most questions and say, no, I have no idea who that musician you're talking about is. Can you tell me about them? Yeah. Instead of, oh, yeah, I know who that is.
And then frantically to Google.
Right. And life experience, also part of that data.
Yeah, absolutely. Life experience is part of that data, completely.
Carol Lankor says, when I was in junior high, my science teacher, Mr. Sheffer, told us a story about a guy drowning in an industrial vat of mayonnaise at a mayonnaise fast factory. He said it was impossible to swim in mayonnaise because of its viscosity. Is this true?
Oh, my God. That is such a good question.
You guys did the walking on water thing. You swam in, like, a cornstarch mixture, right?
We swam. No. We ran across a cornstarch mixture for the ninja episode.
Oh, right.
Then we swam in different viscosities of guar gum-based syrup for the swimming in syrup episode. That was funky.
I bet that was a good shower afterwards.
Oh, man.
You have to get, like, the brushes and have a team of decon people scrubbing you down?
No. It washes off quite well.
Okay.
It was funky, though, man.
Do you when you're doing that stuff, do you stick to water-based, viscous stuff?
Yeah. Well, actually, for that, it was just simply cost. I mean, guar gum is not cheap, and, you know, mixing up 10 or 20,000 gallons of it is expensive.
Yeah.
You better get it right.
Yeah.
Swimming in mayonnaise, whether or not it's possible, that just made my list for MythBusters. So I don't know.
It's a quick sandwich.
It might not have
totally surface
something
tension,
I want
to. It's so total. I don't even know if you could mix up enough mayonnaise that would last long enough to be able to swim in.
Think about how many eggs.
Oh,
gross.
That would be awful. Jamie would be so mad if we wasted, 100,000 eggs.
Well, you'd probably. what you'd probably have to do is figure out something that is exactly the same mechanical.
Right,
yeah.
Which is non-trivial.
No, I know. Well, oh. You have a team of researchers. Can't this way work out. Itself out.
Okay.
Oh, gross. All right.
So that's a great question. The answer is I don't know, but that. I want to know.
Go to the desert, find a nice, yeah. warm, sunny day, get out there. Just have a good time.
Cans of tuna.
Let me
cans
know.
Of tuna. Cans of tuna, some white bread.
Crackers.
Yeah, heaven.
Yeah. Just let me know when you're going to do that so I can be as far away as possible. And then Jay Madison.
Is this the last question?
We have a couple. We have one or two more. Jay Madison wants to know, what do you enjoy most, making things, collecting things, or blowing things up?
Blowing things up is at the bottom of that list. Don't get me wrong.
We should fight entropy as a people. That should be our goal, right?
Yes. I greatly enjoy the experience that I've gotten to have with explosives over the years. I'm very grateful for the body of knowledge I've built. But the actual blowing of things up is not in and of itself super awesome. One, it's dangerous, and I've said this before, but you know, we have safety officers and safety protocols that we go through in great detail. But still, you know, our crew relies on Jamie and I to keep them safe. And when we're working with bomb squads, it's tense stuff because you're working with stuff where it's so deadly, you wouldn't know if it actually went off. It's just, that's the end of you.
It's faster than your ability to input information.
Yeah, there's no oh shit moment. There's just...
Well, that's kind of, right? in a grim kind of way, that's comforting at least.
But, you know, so that can be nerve-wracking. Making stuff or collecting stuff, really, it goes back and forth. They both light up different pleasure centers in my brain.
Would you associate collecting stuff with discovering new things? Exists in the world.
See, there's they both come from the same place of wanting an ultimately they both come from a similar place of wanting an object that I can hold on to that gives me satisfaction, right? There's that endorphin release. But the making, I find the problem-solving process of making to be really meditative and really important in my mental health profile. You know, I need to spend a certain amount of time in my shop, like contemplating the cosmos, in order to be like fully ready to go. The collecting stuff, which involves sometimes things I can't make or don't want to take time to make, or sometimes finding things that I didn't know were there and can add to a collection of other things. For instance, I just bought a piece of Univac hardware.
Really?
On eBay.
Which part?
Yeah. So I bought this beautiful, I'll show it. We'll do a podcast where I'll show it. I had never searched for Univac on eBay, and now I believe some people will.
There's the market for that stuff just went through.
I'm glad I got in on the ground floor
building kit.
You have 1 week from the time we record this to buy as much as you want.
Right, right. I found this new thing, and I can't wait for it to arrive. And I've got a place on the shelf all set up.
Is it going to go with the bit and the bite?
Yeah, exactly. And for me, the collecting stuff. There's a bunch of different satisfactions from that. Having it in my collection as part of this, you know, that cacophony in my shop that feeds me. There's also being able to show it to other people and getting them excited about it. And I had some Apple engineers over at the shop a couple of weeks ago, and they went nuts over the bit byte and the giant gigabyte. They thought that was awesome. And their reaction to that also gives me like a super amount of pleasure, because if there's one thing I love about my obsession with objects, it's spreading it to other people. That's deeply
totally sad.
Everyone
it.
Has their they contribute.
Yeah, so that's the story.
So then it's a tie. It's a mixed bag, is what you're saying. Is,
yeah. Well, you know, look, when I'm in a hotel in the middle of nowhere, it's all about the looking at things to collect or to. Actually, I do both. So I look for things to collect and I look for things to add to the collection, but I also do work with projects that I've got on the burner, sorting photos and sub-sorting subfolders of things I want to build or contract
plans
out.
Plans and diagrams.
Plans and diagrams, yeah. Tings of dot nature.
The last question comes from Karen, and she wants to know, how does the MythBusters universe connect to education for a healthier, more sustainable future?
Well, we never set out to make an educational show, but I think where MythBusters does connect with education, and aside from the fact that many science teachers who are really the boots on the ground where it comes to the next generation of critical thinkers use MythBusters as a teaching aid, Because whether we've gotten it right or we've gotten it wrong, we are a point of departure for discussing physics concepts, chemistry concepts, etc. I think the lesson that I would hope people take away from MythBusters is to trust your intuition. You know, I think that education now, and teachers will say this until they're blue in the face, the concentration on testing is anathema to actual learning.
You mean testing in the sit down and here's your Scantron form and
Exactly. Teaching to the test, right? Which is effectively the foundation of the debacle known as the No Child Left Behind Act, which should be called Behind Children Left Behind Act.
We brought the average way down with that. It was,
The idea that you should punish schools that are doing poorly by giving them less resources is, it's a guaranteed way to concentrate all the energy on a smaller number of schools rather than spreading the, oh God, it makes me so mad. Really, in order to learn, in order to inculcate yourself with a new concept, you need to be interested. And in order to be interested, you need to be exercising your brain to the problem, not trying to figure out what you've memorized and where it fits into this multiple choice question. And when you do use your brain to solve a problem based on information you've gleaned empirically, you have really learned something. And you've learned something that you can apply to something else. When all you're doing is memorizing, all you've got in your head is a topology. Sorry, is a... No, that's not the word I'm thinking of.
A tautology.
Oh, my God. My brain is fried today. But when taxonomy. When all you have in your brain is a taxonomy of the things you're supposed to memorize, cross-referencing between them is not natural. What is natural for cross-referencing is when you really understand why something works. So to me, the other thing that MythBusters has to do with education is getting your hands dirty. Mm-hmm. Neither of us has training in sciences. I've got a high school diploma. Jamie's got a degree in Russian linguistics. Interested in what the big question is, and we're interested in how to answer it for ourselves to our satisfaction, and we are genuinely interested in that. We make up the shooting of MythBusters every single day. And I think that narrative is an honest one. It's one we're proud of and one we stand behind. And to me, kids getting their hands dirty and learning their own intuition and learning how to ask questions that they can figure out how to answer is the soul of a good education.
I think that's there's nothing to add.
those are great questions. One more reason to love Etsy.
So this is our special Etsy answer special.
Yes.
If you and we'll do some regular answer some questions from readers soon. The email address for that is podcast@tested.com, and put the subject line questions for Adam in. Reviews, comments, feedback, we read it all. We appreciate it. We can't respond to everything, but it's all good and it's all noted. We'll be back next Tuesday with another edition of Still Entitled, The Adam Savage Project.
We will.
Until then, see you guys later.
See you guys later.